Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Michael Bauer, Alexandra Eidenberg, Jennifer Nevins, and Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video, every Sunday night at beyondthebeltway.com. And if you miss the show, it's always there. You can always find it. Well, we have just tons of things to talk about in the next 2 hours. Once upon a time, we would have said maybe the State of the Union was the big story, but again, it was usurped by the release of the Nunes memo about the head of the House Republican, the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. And this was the memo that everybody thought was going to be a bombshell. And tonight we have two Republicans, we have two Democrats, lots of people listening around the country. My question to you, Chris Roebling, you're one of our card-carrying Republicans. Was the memo the bombshell you thought it was? And also, what were the one or two most important points in that memo to you personally?
Yes, it puts me in mind of the Frank Church hearings in the mid-1970s when a congressional committee was investigating abuses by the FBI and indeed domestic spying.
Yes.
And uncovered the history of FBI abuses relative to, say, Martin Luther King at the direction of Robert F. Kennedy. I think that this is the single most significant abuse of and by the FBI since then, and maybe we get a chance to talk about that later. In terms of what's so significant to me, the fact that a campaign handout from the Hillary campaign through Vladimir Putin's PR firm in Washington was actually presented without context to the FISA court.
This is the dossier.
The dossier. This is an abuse, and I believe that I know that my Democrat friends are very interested in belittling it, but I think over time it's going to cause significant problems.
Michael Bauer is one of our card-carrying Democrats, back for the second week in a row. Michael, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Your reaction to the memo, and was it the bombshell that it had been hyped to be?
I think the memo was not the bombshell. I think the memo will have no effect whatsoever on the Mueller investigation. I think the major effect of the memo is to, unfortunately, further politicize the House Intelligence Committee and poison the environment in the U.S. House between both political parties.
Jennifer Nevins is a Trump Republican, very strong, long before it was fashionable.
Yeah.
In some circles, it's not very fashionable today.
Still not, no.
Within Cook County, right, where we do this program. But your reaction, was it the bombshell you thought it was?
I would say it wasn't for this reason. I was hoping for something that was so cut and dried that it could cut through any kind of spin. Because with the low information voters and the vast majority of people who haven't been paying attention to this, like we all have because we're political junkies, I wanted there to be something that was so you just couldn't even spin it if you tried. For me, it was pretty damning because it was confirmation of something that a lot of us suspected. You had confirmation from the FBI. They haven't refuted this. They didn't want it released, but they haven't refuted it. But I was kind of hoping for a little more. I think we're going to get more. I do think this is just the spear, you know, the tip of the spear, I should say. But I have to say that I was hoping for fireworks, and so far I haven't gotten it.
Alexandra Eidenberg also joins us. She's our other Democrat. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me today, Bruce.
What's your reaction? There was a lot of hoopla for this. From a Democratic perspective, could it have been a lot worse for you guys?
You know, I was expecting more from it. I think that we all were. You know, I really think it's a bunch of nothing, and that's, you know, what's going on. And for me, I think that the FBI, it's their job to look into things. And when Trump is in constant siege, and, you know, I get that Republicans don't like it that way, but I think it's time we need to look into things. And the FBI did. And unfortunately, you know, this is where we stand. I think that we're looking at Trump and we want to know what's going on.
The one thing I wish would have happened is I wished that the Republican and the Democratic memos would have been released concurrently.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that the Democratic memo should be released. I'd like to see all the basic information released as well, so the American people really can see everything in context. Mm-hmm. Because the Democrats have raised some questions.
Mm-hmm.
To me, one of the questions that the Democrats raised that is most interesting to me, in their summary memo, and even in the press release that went with it, it put a quote into Andrew McCabe's mouth. He is the former deputy head of the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
It put words in his mouth suggesting that there would have never been a movement to the FISA court had this dossier not been present.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they summarized that. I'd like to see the transcript and find out how accurate that summary of what he had to say, because to me that was like a good housekeeping seal of approval when I read that. But I would like to hear it or see it in print.
I think that the transcripts of the testimony will come out appropriately redacted. I think that the Democratic memo will come out. The Democratic memo is behind this memo because it was written after the Democrats saw this memo. That's why it's not on the same time sequence, because
right.
there is a very elaborate process for getting these things unclassified. But I think that you're right. We deserve to see the transcripts of the testimony, and we deserve to see the FISA court submissions when appropriately redacted so as not to compromise right. our intelligence gathering capability.
But don't you believe, given the fact that the Democratic memo has to also go to the White House to be reviewed,
yeah.
if President Trump were to do something or say something that memo,
yeah, you know,
then that just opens another can of worms, don't you think?
Just real quickly, I believe that this – I think that Democrats – not our two Democrats here tonight, but the Democrats in Washington who were talking about this were generally lying about it and saying that it was going to compromise sources
right.
and methods. And obviously it was written not to do so. Almost no words were changed in the final unclassification of the document. If the Democrats submit a document to the process that includes reference to sources and methods, then that has to be redacted. And the partisanship to which Michael refers – I think would be pointed up by Democrats then attacking the White House for redacting their memo.
But Chris, first of all, don't you think that there's a problem that we're actually talking about a Republican memo and a Democratic memo being issued? I have to tell you, I think if we were looking at the Senate Intelligence Committee between Richard Burr, the chairman, and Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat, that you'd never see a Republican memo and a Democratic memo. You'd see something coming out of the Senate Intelligence Committee as a whole. And I think
but
it is
sometimes indicative. Sometimes with a majority and a minority opinion.
Okay,
so.
but I
you
think it
that.
Is indicative of what is going on in this country. That is, frankly, the Intelligence Committee was the last area where I thought we had bipartisanship. That we're even talking about a Republican memo and a Democratic memo. This is insanity.
Well, it's also a time when we're talking about FBI agents who are Republicans or FBI agents who are Democrats, which is a part of a discussion that we're going to move to when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. I'd like to get your reaction. If you read the memo, I certainly have read of the memo. Let's hear from you and see whether or not you think that this memo was what you thought it would be. Or, as the Democrats have suggested, is it just a lot of smokescreen? Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont, back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. And I want to pick up on a point that Chris Roebling made in response to the first question. He made reference to Frank Church, the Democrat from Idaho, who was the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee back in the 1970s. And that was the committee, and he wasn't the only one on the committee, but he was the chairman of the committee. There was bipartisan action in that committee. And they revealed, they pulled back the veil over American intelligence. Abuses by the CIA and FBI, massive abuses by each, okay? And I just want to make reference, because I know we have a lot of people listening to this program on KBOI in Boise, Idaho, and I've referenced this about a year ago, and I'm going to reference it again tonight. If you go to the museum.tv website, museum.tv, you go to the archives area, you can look up under it. It's my audio history of my audio interviews. In 1978, I interviewed Senator Frank Church I actually interviewed him twice. And interviews with Frank Church are on that website. And it describes what's going through his mind when at that particular time, virtually every single day for month after month, revelations and abuses by the FBI and CIA were staggering.
And was he
they
not
were
a
flabbergasted.
Was he not a patriot?
In my view, he was one of the most liberal members of the United States Senate. He ran for president, tried to make more on this issue. He was not successful when he ran for president in 1976. But if you're interested, and again, this is a first-person account of what's going through the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee when some of these abuses of the FBI are coming out in the 1970s. Again, it's museum.tv. Go into the archives area, and it's the Bruce Dumont audio. And again, we've got a couple of interviews.
Just a real teeny thing. The only reason that Richard Burt and Devin Nunes have committees to chair is the result of the Frank Church hearings.
Yes.
That whole sequence created the intelligence and domestic and foreign oversight programs of the United States Congress.
So what I don't understand is we have an inspector general right now for the Department of Justice that's doing his own independent investigation of the FBI and the Justice Department handling of this matter. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we waiting for the IG report to come out? And then whoever on House Intelligence wants to issue their own report could do so. It seems to me you want the independent report coming out first. Isn't that the logical process?
Well, I think that there's a lot to commend that, but it is a political process. And I think that this has now been described by Chairman Nunes as the end of phase one. In other words, I believe that Nunes now describes himself and the committee as having moved to phase two, which is the State Department. Mm-hmm. So maybe there is some sense of Nunes, we have completed what happened at the FBI. Here's our document. And he has promised more memos. I think we're going to have a memo from Nunes and a memo from the Democrats on what happened at the State Department.
The one thing is clear is that the dossier was paid for by the Democrats, the DNC, and the Clinton campaign. It became part of the campaign, and the FBI used that when they went and applied for the FISA court in their application. The Democrats say that Carter Page was on everybody's radar before that.
Right, right.
So they're basically dismissing, well, the dossier maybe wasn't that important. But Democrats, I want to hear from you. Do you think that the dossier is a key element of this? Because a lot of Democrats are dismissing that. They're saying, you know, that was sort of an inconsequential thing. That doesn't seem inconsequential to me.
The way the FISA court works is you get a FISA warrant and you have to come in every 90 days and have it renewed.
Right.
So there was already a FISA warrant on Carter Page because he was approached in 2013 by Russia to become an agent for Russia, and the FBI knew this.
Okay.
So the question becomes, in renewing the FISA warrant at some point, what role did the dossier play in the judicial panel renewing the FISA warrant and eavesdropping?
It sounds to me like the dossier was there. Even James Comey said it was salacious and it was uncorroborated. He even said that.
Unverified.
Okay. Yes.
Unverified. I want to say,
but the point is, it seemed to me maybe that was the only thing they had that they could use to go back to get authorization for another six months.
But we're all just speculating here. I don't know what was in the mind.
But what we do know is that they used this dossier in some form. Okay, they used it.
Yes.
And Comey admitted that it was unverified. It was at the beginning stages of being vetted. Yeah. But they went forward and used it anyway. And then Steele had been fired by the FBI. So the FBI then takes his dossier after he's been fired. Apparently, they did view him as a credible person after he had been dismissed for incredible bias and making statements that he despised Trump and didn't want him to become president. But yet they accept the dossier. Comey knew it. He signed off on using that dossier. To what extent the dossier...
By the way,
That alone should cause a problem there. So whether we can argue about what it's speculation, what role the dossier played, although the FBI is not disputing the part in the memo that says this played a huge role in us getting the warrants. They haven't disputed that.
Right. And Nunes said on Brett Baer on Friday afternoon, it was the number one item that was presented to the court and it was the most significant item. And then they have the indirect quote to which Bruce referred earlier from McCabe about the but-for cause of the warrant. And I also
and the
Michael,
Isikoff story
and the Isikoff story and but
the circular reporting,
the circular
which is
reporting.
Another problem.
But Michael, I disagree with you. I know that Page was of interest in 13 because he was identified as a target of Soviet Russian intelligence.
Yes.
So okay. So he was under surveillance at that time, but he was not under surveillance in October of 2016. So the October 2000. Remember that they tried to get a warrant in the summer of 16, and they were turned down.
Right.
They went back in October. Now, the other question, which my former roommate David Rivkin raised on the Laura Ingraham show a couple of nights ago, why did they go on the 15th of October? What is it about the 15th of October? Why are they going to the FISA court about a presidential campaign on the 15th of October with the election day just 2 or 3 weeks away? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, this will all be revealed in the fullness of time.
Right.
But the FISA, it appears, based on public sources, that the FISA court was led by the United States Department of Justice and the clearances from FBI to consider the Hillary campaign handout from Vladimir Putin's PR firm to overturn the Magnitsky Act as sacred writ. As serious intelligence product, and it was a campaign handout.
Alexandra, I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
As a Democrat, one of the points that the Democrats have been saying repeatedly over the last several months and certainly over the last 72 hours is that the Republicans are joining in a lockstep attack on the FBI. Do you agree with that?
So I think you guys know I'm running for state representative, and I'm very focused on what's going on locally here in Illinois. And so what I'm loving right now is hearing everyone focus on the federal level. And so you'll have to excuse me, as someone who's taken a very deep dive into local politics, I'm loving hearing you guys talk about the federal level, because this is what I hear every day as I'm going door to door, is the issues going on with people's upset and what's going on with Trump and how things are not going well. I think ultimately we're in a team sport atmosphere right now, and no longer is our government working together to get things done. And we have Republicans and Democrats, and we're no longer focused on the people. We're just trying to pit ourselves against each other. As it pertains to the FBI and everything going on right now, you know, I think that there's some value. We have to look into things. We can't be, you know, trying to say that it's inappropriate for the FBI to do their research and understand what's happening. We want to point the finger at Hillary. We want to say she gave this data. I think that, you know, if we want to say that's inappropriate, I want to understand why it's inappropriate to try to expose people attacking our democracy. If people are attacking our democracy, I think it's appropriate for us to investigate and understand what's going on.
Well, let me ask you the question. Some would argue that the people that are attacking the democracy are the Democrats. They've had this as an issue. They're beating Donald Trump over the presidency. He's been elected president. He is the president. It's resist, resist, resist from day one.
Yeah.
And the people that are tearing the president down are Democrats in a partisan way. And in this particular case, they may have helped, according to this memo, they've had some help with key people in the Justice Department and the FBI.
Wait a minute.
Because they did some
wait. Things. Wait a minute.
That's a very
wait a minute.
All right, let's go ahead.
I mean, all of a sudden, we're turning things topsy-turvy. How many people in the Trump campaign met with Russian nationals during the course of the Trump presidential campaign and then either denied it or were unable for a while to recall their meetings with Russian nationals?
And we know about them. And we know about them, right?
We know about some of them.
Well, we know about a lot of them.
Okay. You know, can we
and
talk?
By the way, let me just say.
And by the way,
I believe that we should know about them. I am for complete transparency on this issue.
You know
what I'm just saying is that, you know, the Democrats it's a recent thing. They have begun to question any challenge, anything that's said about this sacred cow called the FBI, say the FBI. And, you know, it was a sacred cow for Republicans for 60, 70 years. But in this particular case, if you look at the history of the FBI, whether it is some of the things that Chris just referenced or going back to its founder, J. Edgar Hoover, there have been some really bad apples in the FBI. The vast majority of them are not. But let's not with, you know, a puppy dog.
There's bad apples everywhere.
All these poor. Well, but that's not what the Democrats are saying. They're saying any criticism of the FBI somehow is destroying the Republic.
Well, I think that was the tone of the New York Times' piece this morning, which claimed to describe a Trump war on law enforcement, which I think is absurd.
Well,
but
and it's
illustrative.
He's trying to hide from what he's
it's
done.
It's rich coming from a party that whose mantra often has been question the establishment, question authority. But it is a political game.
We've
when it suits your
back
purpose.
Back shortly from Chicago. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv.
Bruce
Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for your calling. And we're going to take a call right now. John, listening to us in Holyoke, Colorado, and he's listening on Sirius XM Satellite Radio tonight. Go ahead, John.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, sir?
It's great to be on your show. I listen to it every Sunday.
Thank you, sir. How can we help you?
Yeah, I'm driving through purple Colorado. It's not blue. It's not red.
Yeah.
But, I just have a hard time wrapping my mind around Democrats sticking up for the FBI and the CIA. I mean, look at the number of abuses that the FBI or the ATF or the CIA has engaged in over the last 60 years. I mean, you've got Ruby Ridge, you've got Waco, you've got the debacle of 100,000 cops on the streets of Bill Clinton, which created the gang issues we have today. You've got Chile, you've got Guatemala, you've got Iran. I mean, you know, why?
And you got Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah, and you got Dr. Martin Luther King. And why don't the Democrats just say, "See, we told you"?
Well, let's let Michael respond,
John. If you were listening earlier, what I said is there's an inspector general right now investigating the Department of Justice and the FBI, and I don't understand why everyone isn't just waiting for this independent inspector general report to be issued, and let's see where the cards fall.
Chris Roebling.
I think I distrust all concentrations of power, federal, state, and local, private sector, public sector. I don't think, you know, concentrations of power that are opaque are our friends. They're trying to get something from us, wherever they are. And so I believe, and I had the privilege of working at CIA when I was in college, and I love the agency, and I nothing but patriots inside of it. But the caller is right. When you're not exposed to sunlight, bad things start happening. And we know that, as the caller has said. I think we have to have ongoing oversight, and that's got to be very critical. You can't just accept the press release. You can't accept the handout. And in this case, a campaign handout went to a judge who signed an order that allowed the government to spy on Americans. Mm-hmm. And 30 years ago, if this had come out, Democrats would have their hair on fire, and they would be attacking the entire structure that produced that result.
Right.
Absolutely, and here's the part that just absolutely slays me is that this process, this violation of our constitutional rights, or worse yet, of human rights, clear around the globe, has become so trivial that now Donald Trump can politicize it.
Right.
No. Good point.
You don't want anybody to take advantage of this, Trump or Pelosi.
Absolutely.
Or Schumer or Mitch McConnell,
and also part of this feeling, the way the media has sort of, you know, weighed in on this, generally weighing in on the support of the Democrats, it's basically scolding Republicans, how dare you raise questions about the CIA? Because what they do is they conflate, as Chris just said, they use the term this attack on law enforcement. He's not attacking law enforcement. He's not attacking the FBI. He's talking about some selected leadership in FBI that basically have not acted in a responsible way with any credibility. So, again, it's a few apples in the barrel. But just as we say when we, you know, when there's an incident with a bad cop, you know, everybody says, well, that's just as he's just as, you know, an apple in a bigger barrel. Well, that's exactly what this is. I mean, I would say, and I've said on this program, the FBI and the CIA, the vast majority of them are acting constitutionally, and they're doing a great job protecting the United States. But let's not be so blind and so frankly ignorant to believe There's not some bad apples and bad actors in each of those institutions that abuse the Constitution, including the founder of the FBI. Now, that goes back 60 years, but let's not forget it.
Right. And you know what, Bruce, but some of this is really disingenuous on the part of the Democrats, because when Comey came out and was going to reopen the investigation into Hillary, what did we hear, including from Nancy Pelosi, who wanted his removal, wanted James Comey to get the heck out of Dodge. And that was OK then. And there was no calls from the media or fellow Democrats saying you're besmirching the FBI. That wasn't even part of the jargon at that point. So it is a political thing. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. Here.
By the way, speaking of a political thing, I want to get your reaction. It seems to me that also, this is not the first time that James Comey has showed his true colors, but I think his tweets this week against the president responding to this also showed him and shows him to be pretty much of a you know, petty partisan. Do you agree with that, Michael?
I have to tell you, I actually haven't followed James Comey's tweets this week.
Oh, know, my God. What the heck have you been doing?
I know he's issued several tweets.
Are you one of those people looking at state issues?
James, no. James Comey, go ahead.
I want to tell you something.
He brought up all McCarthyism.
Yeah.
I mean, he brought up McCarthyism.
He brought it up.
But you know what? I don't think most people are paying attention to this stuff.
Well,
right
I agree
now.
With that, too. Most people are not. Most people are happy that they see more investment, more jobs, higher income, more money in the paycheck, greater competition for jobs, increases, payments, you know, pay scales. That's what most people are focusing on. Thank goodness.
But that's not the people that you're running into.
No, I'm running into people
you're
that...
First of all, you're running into Democrats because you're running into a Democratic primary.
Right.
And you're in a very wealthy, affluent area.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So to them, $1,000 might be crumbs.
You know what? I don't think that's crumbs for anyone. I want to be very clear, though. I think that ultimately, right now, with what's going on with the tax reform, I think that, and I'm a small business owner, and so, you know, supposedly I'm the market that's really been helped. I'm not feeling helped, and I think as a Democrat, you know, we as Democrats want to see public services. We want to see, you know, money in the system in order to afford things. And this tax reform, I would rather see that $1,000 in the system in order to make sure that us as a collective can succeed and thrive. And $1,000 is not crumbs, and it's really important to invest that into our communities, and I think that that's what's critical.
Where are the people who are getting the $1,000 back going to spend that $1,000? Not in the communities?
No, they're going to put it under their mattresses. That's what they want us to believe, Chris. It's going to go in a hole in their backyard, and they're not going to spend it anywhere.
I just wish there were some Democrats out there who would say, you know, sometimes the state is the answer, but there are many times when the private sector is the answer. The state is not always the answer. If you want to take that $1,000 back from regular people, that sounds like California, where folks in the legislature are proposing a special tax to reclaim from regular Americans the benefits that they're going to be receiving from the federal tax reform measure.
I want to move back to calls. Rick in Nashville, Tennessee, listening to us on the internet tonight. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call, Bruce. Your show. It's a refreshing way to end Sunday night.
Thank you very much.
You know, all day today, I heard the pundits on TV talking about the Democratic pundits chastising Republicans for having the audacity to question the FBI.
Yes.
Well, excuse me, but we now learn that the fix was in from the beginning, that even before Hillary sat down with Peter Strzok, the decision was made there was going to be you know, we're going to treat her with kid gloves. Yep. They didn't put her under oath. It was just a travesty of investigations. We also learned of the bias that Peter Strzok had, and that Andrew McCabe, through with his wife receiving campaign funds for her campaign
right.
As a Democratic. I'm a retired sheriff's detective, and I can categorically tell you that I was taken off many cases, asked to recuse myself, so to speak, because I happened to know of the suspect or knew his parents. You know, and that little innuendo alone, required me to stay off the case. Yet we have major FBI players that are obviously biased and prejudiced, and they're leading the investigation.
Yeah.
So I agree with Alexandra that obviously there should be an investigation into the way this investigation was conducted, number one, and that the participants on the investigative side should have never been there in the first place.
Do you think that there should be a special investigator, special counsel hired to look into that, or do you think that letting the House and Senate intelligence committees do their job and prepare their reports will be good enough for you personally?
I would want a special investigator, and I'm hoping that Trey Gowdy, who is going to step down, would take that post, because obviously you have there's too much politics involved when it's in the intelligence committee, as we see with these Republican memo, now Democratic memo coming out. At least with an independent counsel, I would hope that we would get a unbiased and just the facts. I mean, that's all the American people are asking for.
Rick, let me ask you the question. Do you want the Democratic memo to come out as well?
Sure.
Is there anything about the Republican memo that, as a trained investigator, which you've described yourself as, is there anything about what's in the Nunez memo that you would like to know more of, or wasn't really nailed down to your satisfaction?
I guess I was satisfied with it for the time that it took to comply, to compile it.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard references, that they misquoted Andrew McCabe. Well, okay, if they misquoted him, let's see his transcript.
That should be an easy one. In fact, I would say that from a political standpoint, somebody on the committee should have included his exact transcript when they released it, if indeed it is a transcript that they have properly reproduced or at least summarized in their report. Listen, thanks very much, Rick, for being with us.
Thank you.
1-800-723-8029. We will continue, and we're going to be talking about the State of the Union and the Democrats' response. John McCain. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. And again, we're going to switch gears, Al, but I do want to make one point. Again, as you know, I'm frequently critical of Meet the Press, and I watched it again today. And Chuck Todd did an interview with John Brennan, the former head of the CIA.
Oh,
and the interview began by him announcing that NBC News has hired John Brennan, the fired head of the CIA, fired by Donald Trump. They have hired them as their analyst for national security. So the next time you watch NBC and they have him as a guest, just remember, this is a guy who was fired by Donald Trump.
Are we going to get to international relations? Because we could talk about the YPK Kurds and just how awful the Obama administration screwed that up, so that we are now actually, our armed forces are now arrayed against those of Turkey. And this is potentially the first time in the history of NATO that two member nations of the alliance have been arrayed against each other. And every word, every element of this was attacked 3 years ago when the Obama administration said, we're going to go with not even the PKK Kurds, who are bad.
Right.
They went to the YPK Kurds, which are worse. And this is the kind of thing Brennan was doing constantly. He was a treasonous, in my opinion, a treasonous detriment to the security of the United States and our allies.
I want to kind of broaden my discussion, because I want to make a point. I don't think any credible news organization should hire, maybe those words should not be used in the same sentence anymore, but a credible news organization should not hire a former official of any administration to be on the air and give them access to offer analysis. I think, you know, just as a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans say that if you are serving in government, you should have a moratorium before when you can go back and lobby for the government because you're taking secrets and you're making money with your secrets. I feel the exact same way. And I don't care whether it's a Republican. I don't like Rick Santorum, even though he was not certainly a major player, former United States senator. But I think there should be a period of time when if you are serving in the United States government, there should be a moratorium before you're hired by a network to go on. Because everyone, certainly if you have been fired by someone, there's going to be an axe to grind. And again, not only does John Brennan have an axe to grind, but John Brennan has a record that is less than stellar. Right. So when NBC makes this big deal that they've hired them as their analyst, I would say that no network should do this. Are you comfortable with – well, you can go beyond just Brennan, but are you – how do you feel about that?
I mean, I saw Corey Lewandowski being hired by CNN
as a contributor. But that's a commentator, that's an opinionist, and that's a – you know, certainly that's a contributor. Of course you'd have that. We have that on the left and the right. Otherwise, you'd have nobody on TV.
Right.
But when you have somebody doing straight analysis. Well, look at George Stephanopoulos. He's not – he doesn't come off like a partisan. That's not his role. His role is to be this mediator. He does some analysis. He says, I'm treading the middle. Well, come on. We all know you worked for the Clinton administration for how many years? So it is, it's,
Matthew
I think
Dowd
it's
is almost worse.
It's farcical because they'll bring up the Fox News. Oh, well, look at Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity is out and proud and says, I am biased.
Yes.
Here's my He's bias. Nothing. It's a totally different situation.
I wish he would.
Right.
I mean, I don't understand what you're looking for. I mean, is there such a thing as objectivity?
Well,
everyone's walking in with a bias.
It's not just a bias.
Question.
It's an animus. It's an open, flaming animus with John Brennan.
It's an agenda. And you know, this is it's an endless question in American journalism because, you know, we sort of thought, I think as a nation, that journalism here was going to be independent of party affiliation. Okay. Whereas in Europe, if you would go to Vienna, there's going to be a socialist newspaper, then there's Democrat newspaper, a communist newspaper, and a conservative news. You know, everybody knows exactly, oh, this one is this one, right? They got the menu.
Yeah.
In the United States, we were supposed to have an objective press. That all began to crumble in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I think we're seeing vividly the result. I mean, I know that Bernstein and Woodward are still with us, but what we are seeing on this memo issue, and I know you want to talk about the State of the Union,
but
we're seeing on the memo issue, 99% of mainstream media is approaching this right out of the Democrat playbook. And I believe that the mainstream media is a super PAC for the National Democratic Party.
Does that include Fox News?
Fox is an odious contributor to the Republican Party.
Okay.
I wish Fox was better. I'm finding myself looking at things like the Japanese feed on my cable and also Bloomberg. I watch Bloomberg a lot more.
Okay.
And CNBC.
So you have
by the way, what I would say, and then I'm going to hear what I would say also is that if you want analysis, or you want analysis, or if you want your opinion, restated, you can go to Fox. You can go to CNBC, you can go to CNN, and you can get your slant of the news.
Right.
When it comes to hard news, and when it comes to the big three networks, CBS, ABC, and NBC, those network newscasts and those network departments should be without political slant. That's what I want. I want to get my objective news from the big three networks. And when I want to get my analysis, I'm going to go or I'm going to flip through the channels and I'm going to get a little bit of Fox and a little bit of CNN. Alexandria, what do you think?
I'm thinking of this like a small business owner. And so as a small business owner, when I'm hiring, I want to hire people that are inside. They understand things. They know. I sell insurance. If I could hire someone who works at Blue Cross Blue Shield to work for my agency, I feel like that gives me a leg up. up. And so thinking of it on the business end, I think you want to hire the best reporters. And those are the people that know what's going on the inside. And all news is slanted. No matter if we try to say that it's, you know, unbiased, we bring our opinions to the table. And that's the spin that everything gets.
But if you acknowledge,
Trump,
I think the key
Donald
is acknowledging.
If Donald Trump fired you are right. Not going to be fair to him.
No.
That's
not
my
at
point.
All.
1-800-723-8, and he's fired a lot of people, so maybe that's why he's got all the problems. 1-800-723-8029, back shortly with another full hour talking about the State of the Union and DACA. We're going to solve DACA in the next hour.
Hey y'all, I'm Blake Shelton. I love that country music connects people all over this great nation, but unfortunately so does something else, childhood hunger. 15 million children struggle with hunger in America. That's why the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks works to rescue our surplus food to help provide billions of meals to families in need across the country. Join the fight against hunger at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Talk about the State of the Union, and I'm going to get start with the Democrats. The Democrats sat on their hands. The president is out there. He's given his speeches. The Republicans are popping up like Jack in the Box on cue, which is predictable by any partisan way. But the Democrats, as he's talking, they're taking reaction shots of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats, and they're all sitting there. Sourpuss, glum, sitting on their hands. I mean, it was, I was stunned. I can't remember when the Democratic opposition looked so disgusted with the President of the United States. And he was hitting on some issues that were, should have been popular with Democrats.
Well,
your reaction.
Okay, the State of the Union address to me is one with a lot of symbolism. A little bit of theater, mm-hmm. A lot of theatrics, and I think Trump did it amazingly well. He had these guests picked out, sitting with the First Lady in her box, heroes, veterans, heroes of mm-hmm. many kinds. Now, the person who played it best to me, listening to the president speak, was the Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. Neil Gorsuch sat there, and every time the cameras panned to him, he had this. Look at his face.
Mm-hmm.
It was a straight face. It wasn't a positive. It wasn't a negative. It was just a straight face listening. You never saw any emotion on his face. I have to tell you, I saw the look on Schumer's face and Nancy Pelosi's face, and I thought, I don't know what audience they're playing to. They should have taken cues from Neil Gorsuch and mm-hmm. realized the cameras were going to pan on them and just had a straight face if they didn't like what the president was saying.
Mm-hmm. Your reaction, Jennifer?
Well, I think what really caught me by surprise was when the North Korean dissident was raising his crutches over his head, this triumphant. Anybody could rally around that.
Right.
And they panned over to Cory Booker, who looked like he was going to spit nails at that moment. And I thought to myself, you know, this is just really bad optics. And I think that's how I would describe the Democrat response to that speech. It's one thing to disapprove. It's kind of, I don't mind people kind of really showing their displeasure at certain moments. But at universal rallying points like that, to have this nasty look on your face, like you said, Michael, you have to wonder, who is that playing to?
So,
go ahead.
I think I felt like it was playing to me, actually. So when Nancy Pelosi was making snarky faces, seemed like she was gossiping, whispering to the side, I felt like she was purposely ignoring our president. president who has been very damaging to our country. And I felt like that was speaking to people that are angry at Trump. And so although I feel like it was a certain kind of disrespect, I would never have done that. Mm-hmm. I thought it was purposeful on her behalf. And so where she just felt like, I'm not going to respect him. Everything he's saying, I don't agree with.
Well,
and
it so might have been very purposeful, but it was, I think, a big mistake.
What do you think, Chris?
I think the Democrats are way, way out of touch with regular people. And I think that, and I say this as a former Democrat, I just think that they are way too caught up in their own view of this thing and in their service to the constituencies that took over the party, mm-hmm. as we've talked about before, in 1972 down in Miami when Wayne Whalen and everybody overturned the structure of the party. And, you know, you got the McGovern thing going. I just think that the party is an interest group association agglomeration, and it's basically just a our favorite, and this will sound very Republican, but we look at the Democratic Party as competing parasites. Why? Because all of these organizations that are their base constituency are all taking money from the government. So if this part of the Democratic coalition gets money, then this part has. And you're hearing it from Nancy Pelosi right now. We've got a horrible, horrible funding problem for the safety of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, because we're walking off the CR thing every 90 days or even every 2 weeks or whatever it is, instead of a regular budget and a full year appropriation. And so Nancy Pelosi is now saying, well, yeah, we can solve that for the military. But to do that, the Republicans have got to spend exactly the same new amount of money on the domestic discretionary spending.
But the Democrats, I mean, even on the issue of infrastructure, on the issue of a second chance for ex-offender.
I agree with
on
Jennifer.
Prescription drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, on family leave.
Right.
I mean, they didn't even respond on family leave.
They were not responding. And I say this with great love. Everyone in my family is a Democrat. They were not responding as Americans. I think that they were responding as Democrats who are very centered on Alexandra's point. They think Trump is odious in his proper person, and they're not going to give him the satisfaction. And I said a year and a half ago, whenever he got elected, he will never be forgiven for getting elected. Never be forgiven.
I don't think that's the issue. The issue is not that he's not forgiven for being elected. I think the trouble that many of us as Democrats have is a great deal with his style. His style is abrasive. His style is, in many ways, is mean-spirited. His style can be very nasty and ugly. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, in his State of the Union address, it was a different Donald Trump.
Yep.
He read a wonderful speech off of a teleprompter, and he read it well. I'm not disparaging it. Yep. And the Democrats misplayed their hand and not joining on the parts where they should have been applauding and approving certain segments. And you're right. Something like family leave is a Democratic issue that Democrats have argued for a long time.
They should have been on their feet for that.
They should have been on their feet for that. Right. Absolutely.
Well, and this is DACA. DACA. I mean, the Democrats are beginning to look – this will sound awful, and please don't hold it against me. They're beginning to look like the Palestinians. And here's what I mean by that. You go and you offer everything, you know, to Yasser Arafat. Bill Clinton tried to do everything he possibly could. Arafat turns him down. You begin to get the idea he'll never be satisfied. Mm-hmm. Here, I think Trump has made a statesmanlike compromise offer to go from the 790,000 to the 1.8 million to give him a path to citizenship. You know what?
And waste a bunch of money on the wall. I mean,
well, what are you going to? What do you have to get everything, or can you compromise?
No, there was no compromise
wait a minute.
At all.
Let me ask you something. By the way, Chris, I agree with you. So where's the Senate vote on the president's proposal? Mitch McConnell controls the Senate calendar. When's the vote going to be? Well,
they can't break. You know how the Senate breakdown is.
No.
Okay?
I don't know until there's an actual vote schedule.
Well,
there be a vote schedule.
McConnell said even today or yesterday that he's scheduling it for a full for an open rule on the floor of the U.S. Senate. I think March or February 10 or 9 or something. Mm-hmm. So I think he's now even got a date. I don't think there's ever been a question that he would schedule it. And I think the only question is it going to be a real legislative enterprise, a real legislative exercise where the, you know, Democrats, Republicans sit down and
I want to elaborate a little more on it. But do you know whether or not the identities of everyone in the gallery, all the personal stories, the very personal, mm-hmm. the very emotional yeah. stories right. that were in the gallery, mm-hmm. was that known to everyone in advance?
Yes. They were announced 2 days ahead of time okay. by the White House press office.
So the Democrats
knew
that these very emotional stories were going to be told, and they still reacted
in the way that they reacted.
Ignoring the African-American parents of the two girls
Horrible.
Who were killed by the Salvadoran gang was right, the right, most right. outrageous right. thing I've seen.
And the rationale,
like
the and the rationale they
were
used
much more warm and positive.
But the rationale they used is that they were using these people as props. They denigrated these individuals by calling them props.
But we got to be back, and we're going to follow that up in a moment. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Those in the gallery have been referred to by some Democrats and some in the media as props. Now, presidents have been using people in the gallery for the last 20 years that I can remember.
Right. Since Air Florida, Reagan.
Okay. Yeah. So the question to you is, do you view them as props? How do you view them, Michael?
I view them as symbols that every president fills the gallery with individuals who can illustrate a point that the president wants to make. And that's acceptable. That's part of the theatrics of a State of the Union address, that the president has various points he wants to make to the country. He has these people who tug at your emotions. They're intended to tug at your emotions. So in this game that we're playing of Democrats and Republicans, ultimately the game we're playing for is the independents. Mm-hmm. The people in the middle.
We lost the optics
for the independents.
What's your...
So I think that the term props is really difficult. I don't think anyone wants to be referred to as a prop, but I think it's common to have people attend and make your point. I think that my big challenge with him continually making these points was him clapping for himself over and over again.
And looking smugly doing it.
And even when people weren't clapping for him, he's like, clap for yourself. It was awkward and uncomfortable. And I think the amount of people he used to make his points was more than I've seen in the past.
Yes.
And it's because he didn't have value in his own words. He needed to use all these people to make an example in order to have the warmth that he was looking
for. Did he overdo it, Jennifer?
With the people that he used?
Yeah.
I don't think so, because it tied in directly to the points that he was making. And what we don't ever see, we always see people used in these addresses, like you said. But what we don't see is the other side routinely calling them props, and we don't have the media calling Obama's people, oh, look at those props that Obama put up there. We didn't hear that. We hear that when Trump does it. So if it is something that all presidents do, then let's treat it like something all presidents do and not excoriate Trump for using people in a way that he shouldn't have.
I don't think, Chris, I don't think I've ever seen those in the gallery be used to the level of emotion. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, almost uncontrollable crying on the part of those being recognized.
Oh, yeah.
That was sort of uncomfortable to watch.
Well, I mean, some of these people are experiencing awful,
right.
awful years, awful moments in their lives, and they're not through it, but they do speak to the American character. And I think we should say, you know, Reagan started this because his State of the Union, his second or third,
right.
it took place just 6 days after the crash of Air Florida at the 14th Street Bridge. And this individual, a mid-level bureaucrat, pulled over Lenny Slutnick and he got out of his car and in a freezing cold night jumped into the Potomac River and saved a life, or maybe two. I think he saved one life. God love him. God love him. And so Reagan he was the toast of Washington.
Yes.
And Reagan and his team sort of caught on to this and said, this is a great example of the American. And I think that's been done to greater or lesser success by intervening presidents. And I have to say, I believe that Trump, this along with his Davos speech. If you haven't seen the Davos speech, it is a phenomenal speech. And this is a phenomenal speech.
Back to back good speeches.
And then Pence gave an incredible speech at the Knesset. I've been hearing about it ever since.
The response by some Democrats and immediately afterwards, not in the official Democratic response, was that the story of the two young African-Americans from Long Island who were killed by members of MS-13, that was Trump's attempt to paint a broad brush as it relates to Hispanics, and it unfairly brought it into the DACA issue. Do you agree with that? Or is that too far of a stretch?
I absolutely agree with that. I think Trump's using those two couples to illustrate the danger of the undocumented persons doesn't compute. There is not a high crime rate.
Gang members. Yes. They're killers.
Yes. And we are deporting undocumented persons who commit crimes. But the crime rate among undocumented persons is not a very significant crime rate.
This is what really drives me crazy. The M13 gang members are Hispanic. They are. That's just a fact.
El Salvador.
Okay. Right. But that is just a fact. Why is everything have to be looked at what identity group somebody's in or what broader point Trump was trying to make? Could he not have been making a point about gang violence in this country? Could he not have been talking about an African-American family as just a family and not an African-American family?
He could have, but he wasn't.
Did he say from the podium that he was talking about these gang members as representative of an immigrant community?
If he made the point that we are going to take all these gang members and we are going to arrest them and deport them, I don't think anyone would have opposed that.
That was his point. I think
His point is that as a result, we should get rid of all undocumented persons.
He did not say that. He said he was ready to take 1.8 million individuals. Now, let's just understand the validity, the integrity of this 1.8 million. When President Obama, first of all, let's not, President Obama said, I am powerless to change this situation. I turned to Congress. Congress did not change the situation. Eventually, Obama says, I woke up this morning and I decided I have the power to do it. So I'm going to do it. Right. Okay. Now, when Obama,
then the judge says no.
When Obama did it, they identified 1.8 million individuals who could qualify.
Right.
Okay, of those the Obama administration dedicated itself to getting all of the 1.8. They did not succeed for reasons.
That was a could number.
Right, and I'm not saying that they didn't try. I think they tried like crazy to do it. What happened is 780,000 people signed up. That then became the number for DACA until Trump on his own says, the 780 are part of the 1.8. Mm. I will make this offer to the 1.8. And the Democrats say, not good enough.
Right. What, and they're still
what
accusing
is supposed
him.
To be good
well, you
enough?
You know what's good, what's good enough?
We're dealing with not good enough.
Have you seen the denial?
Have you seen a vote in the Senate that the Democrats have
they
voted
all came
against?
Out. They all came let's out and a, said they weren't going to vote
McConnell
for it.
Introduce the bill this week,
all,
and let's have a vote by
out lockstep and said they weren't going to vote for it. Nancy Pelosi said it was a recipe for white supremacists. What she said.
And
they're not going to vote for this.
This, I believe,
first of all, you don't need Nancy Pelosi in
the
House.
Because of Senate. I get it, but come on. You have the leadership saying these things.
You have got Kamala Harris. You've got Sherwood Bollard. You've got Pocahontas from Massachusetts.
They're
whatever
all
her name
out
is.
By the way, that's offensive to call
God.
Her that.
I don't think so. No,
it's
offensive for her to claim a heritage that she cannot even illustrate.
Absolutely.
That's offensive.
Do you think Gohmert? Do you think Jim Jordan are going to vote for giving 1.8 million Dreamers? A path to citizenship?
I believe that if the legislative process were functioning, you've got an offer on the table from the president, and so the Democrats in the Senate and the president can focus on the 1.8. Who knows what you end up getting out of the House?
By the way, the 25 million, which Nancy Pelosi has referred to as ransom for the wall.
Billion, 25 billion.
25 billion ransom.
Yeah, that's offensive.
The point is, when the Democrats and Republicans years ago were agreeing on the cost of a wall,
right? Yes.
It was $42 billion.
The Democrats voted for $42 billion. They're now saying no to $25 billion.
Chuck Schumer agreed to it.
I don't understand. I don't understand. When the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, control the calendars for their respective – wait, let me finish. Control the calendars for their respective houses. Why are we not having a vote on the president's proposal? And by the way, let me tell you what I think about the president's proposal. I would vote for that in a heartbeat.
Okay.
We talked about this last week. If I was a United States senator, I would take this deal, and I don't care what you call the $25 billion. If that's the price to save the 1.8 million Dreamers, it's a price I would pay.
But Chuck Schumer has already said, he has unequivocally said, he is not going to vote for any funding for the wall under any circumstances. And I think the reason for that is there's no chain migration in this bill.
Right.
And the whole thing hinges. That's right. That's just like Jennifer Palmieri admitted in WikiLeaks document, said that this is our key forward to success as a party, is having DACA and chain migration. It is very, very important.
Flip Texas, New Mexico,
Alexandria.
So, and you brought up the key point, and I think that, you know, I hate to be throwing around $25 million. I think that's a lot of money.
A billion dollars.
But I think that ultimately, at the end of the day, it comes down to the chain migration and people being able to bring their families to the United States. Right. And I think that that's the part that the Democrats are not willing to falter
and
on.
And why not?
And why we want them to hold ground.
That's right. And why not? Because they need those voters. It's not enough for the mom
to come
over.
Oh, my God. It's not about the voters.
Then what
it's
is
about
it?
Doing
then
it
what
the
is
right
it?
And bringing
time.
Families
then
together.
Then what is
and
a second cousin and a third uncle and a kissing cousin?
I want to go back. Michael has a question on the table. Michael, you have a question.
We're talking about family migration. We are talking about being able to bring in your parents, being able to bring in your siblings.
They're already allowed.
No, no, no. The proposal that the president made is that you're able to bring in underage children
and your spouse.
So? That's it. I think you should be able to bring your parents.
Not grandparents.
You should be able to bring your siblings.
In a legislative, I posited a legislative act, and in a legislature, that's the kind of thing where you make a deal. And the answer to your question is, Mitch McConnell has said he will schedule this for immediately after the next CR. Now, if he doesn't live up to that, then you've got a new target. But he has said this is scheduled for after
and
the next
wasn't
CR.
Wasn't it supposed to be scheduled before the last
Thursday.
CR?
We're going to talk about the potential.
No,
it was supposed to be before
1-800-723-8029.
It's like the 8th and then the 10th is the date.
We'll be back. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back. Let's go to Tom in Youngstown, Ohio, listening to us on WPIC. Go ahead, Tom.
Good evening, Bruce, and to your guest.
Hello.
In listening to these State of the Union address, there's a lot that I didn't hear about immigration. And immigration, I think, is the most important decision we have to make as a society. Because if we don't get that right, then, you know, we could have a situation eventually where the people who are coming into this country are in numbers that outvote the people that have been here generation after generation. And, you know, if you're going to put a wall up, they could tear it down. I really think that what we need to do is postpone, put a moratorium on any decision, wait until the 2020 census, which is still within Trump's administration this the first term.
Mm-hmm.
And determine how many illegals are here. I mean, it could be 11 million. It could be 30 million. And the whole DACA situation, I think, is a Trojan horse from the standpoint that, okay, we decide that we do it with just what we have, the 1.8 million. Some point along the way, some federal judge could say, well, no, you have to extend that to the grandmother, grandfathers, sisters, brothers, and so forth. Of the parents. In addition to that, you have a situation where at some point along the way, we have to face issues of sanctuary cities, anchor babies, refugees, H-1B visas, modifying state voting methods to assure that only citizens vote, making sure that only citizens get economic benefits, taking a look at minority preferences. From the standpoint, I really think that's just been a magnet for groups coming from certain countries and really discouraging other groups who are not minority.
Tom, let me ask you one quick question, because, again, right now the national debate is focused on the DACA workers. But if we were to wave a magic wand and Congress supported the president, or the president supported what comes out of Congress, and DACA is now an issue in the rearview mirror. But let me just finish. The next issue is going to be, what about the non-DACA illegal immigrants that are in this country? Mm-hmm. We don't know what that number is.
And we don't have a fence on the southern border that should have been there in 1986.
That's right. And then a logical argument, I think, at least from the left, would be, okay, if you've given the DACA workers a path to citizenship, then why don't you give them a path to citizenship?
Right.
That's the slippery slope, although not so slippery.
I would say, Tom, to speak to what you're talking about, I don't claim to speak for every Trump supporter at all, but I have to say that many of us hear the 1.8 million figure. We hear the 700,000 figure, and it's not something that we want. It's not something that Donald Trump ran on. We want border security, and a lot of us do not believe that anyone who is illegal has any right to the services and the things that this country offers, although when it comes to the Dreamers, there can be some compromises made. When Donald Trump threw out this number, the 1.8 million. The reason why many of us didn't immediately jump ship and go screaming down the hallways was, rightly, as it turns out, we do believe that the Democrats are not going to take this deal because chain migration is not part of it. Trump knows who he's dealing with. And we believe that this is a political move. It's a chess maneuver, much like, this is politics. And so he can say this, he can offer this to the Democrats, and the Democrats will predictably turn it down. And this is what's happening. So I hear what you're saying.
Let me ask you this question, which I asked last week. Michael, you were here last week.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a straight up vote,
right?
1.8 path to citizenship, $25 billion for the wall. That's it.
Right.
Take the other two amendments out of the deal.
Right.
Would you support it if you were in the United States?
If we got the wall built. It was on its way to being built. Not, we're going to do this first, and then the wall will come down the pike. Because we've had funding for the wall before, and nothing happened.
It has to be an appropriation.
There has to be, and
I
think that most Trump supporters would go along with that.
Would you agree with that?
I don't really matter, but yeah, I mean, it's a yes or no vote. Yeah, I mean, I would probably go for that, but I want to emphasize.
As you did last week.
I want to emphasize.
I'm enthusiastic about a deal like that.
The $25 billion has to be an appropriation.
Yes.
It can't be an authorization, and that creates legislative issues because you're not supposed to legislate on appropriations, and so you have to have two different vehicles. You know, you've got to have one for the wall and one for the DACA, but it happens all the time. It can be overcome. Go ahead, Tom.
Back to you. We have bipartisan approval, by the way. We got two votes for this.
Could I suggest that there are so many elements here that are not included, and regardless of what's decided, it could be like 1986 where it's just ignored.
Yes.
And rather than have it just ignored or some future administration or some future federal judge trying to interject their own interpretation of it, why don't we do it from the standpoint of, like I said, waiting till the 2020 census, but in the meantime, build the southern border fence, which was part of the 1986 amnesty situation. You know, it's a good faith effort on the Democrats to show that they're actually willing to follow through on whatever is decided. And I really think that we need to have a constitutional amendment out of this. The only way you're going to get rid of anchor babies is through a constitutional amendment. And the only way you're going
That's not true, Tom. Anchor babies are not in the Constitution. That's statutory construction. And that could be changed. And it probably should be changed. But like you said, when you get into immigration and you start mentioning one issue like chain migration, okay, and you say, okay, well, I really want to do X or Y, whatever it is, you immediately, the reason that we have this idea of the comprehensive immigration reform is because what you do over here is then going to affect 75 things over there. So it's easy to say, oh, I oppose anchor babies. But in a certain setting, you might end up voting for anchor babies because you've gotten something else that you find to be equally or more significant.
Honestly, my point of view is build the wall and then we'll go through with the other part
and
of
this,
it.
And
what's
this,
so hard about that?
Well, wait, building a wall without building a wall on its own, to me, is such a waste of expenditure.
It's part of the bill we're talking about, Michael.
If it's part of the bill
we're talking
about,
fine. Yes. Great.
Again, I keep saying,
great.
I don't understand why the Republicans who control both houses of Congress aren't bringing up this legislation on the floor. Let's have a vote.
And it Alexander, will bomb. It will fail in the Senate.
I think this speaks to combining pieces of legislation and not being able to get the job done. And so we're trying to combine the wall. We're trying to combine it with, you know, DACA, and it's not getting done. At the end of the day, you know, and I keep listening to you, both a Democrat and a Republican, saying that you would go for this. I wholeheartedly do not want a wall. I want to be next to our neighbors. These, even the people on our own, you know, the block I live on, these are my neighbors and my friends. I want them to immigrate here. I want to be friends with Mexico. I don't
want
to have,
you
know, my biggest thing is that I feel like we want to spend all this tax dollar on building a wall when we just rolled back on the needed tax dollars we have. We're looking into these big deficits. And we want to waste money on building a wall to separate us from people that I consider
Alexandria,
to be our friends.
Alexandria, let me ask you this question. If DACA workers were to rally outside your house, would you say to them, I'm going to give you no protection because I feel so strong about the wall? I am not going to vote for the wall. And I'm sorry, folks. It means, you know, INS or ICE might be knocking on your door someday. You're not going to get it. In other words, you've got, as a political leader, you've got to basically say to your core constituency, you know what? I know you want 100% of what you're asking for. That's not the way politics works.
Agreed. And I think it's a give and take.
There's a price tag. There's a $25 billion price tag. I think what makes it complicated, however, is when you ask for the chain migration and the lottery issue. Now you're tipping the scales of what the Republicans want, and the Democrats are going to say, listen, we're not going to swallow on the $25 billion and give up China.
And chain migration.
You know what?
I
have great empathy with what Alexandra's saying. I mean, I personally am opposed to the wall. Mm-hmm. But I feel so strongly about allowing these 1.8 million Dreamers to stay in this country that in this game of compromise to get a bill through the both houses and signed by the president,
right.
I would appropriate the $25 billion for a wall if I'm going to allow the 1.8 million Dreamers to stay in this country permanently.
Right.
I'm done.
And we can reverse that and say I am so in favor of a wall on my side that I'm willing to allow, you know, the 1.8 million Dreamers to be. So it is, it's a compromise on both ends. So I hear you and I hear each other.
On each side.
But the radicals on the other side, Michael, aren't hearing
it. Proposal. Tom is suggesting let's wait for the 2020 census and try to use the census to determine what's the size of the undocumented person's problem in this country. The difficulty is how many undocumented persons do you think are going to allow themselves to be counted in this environment?
That's a non-starter. I mean, we know who the Dreamers were originally intended to be.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
And so we can work with that.
Yes,
it's a finite universe, and we ought to
and we can put
address
our around it.
Now, I personally, though, I want to say in response to you, Alexander, I understand your empathy. I have empathy. I'm not a non-empathetic person. Okay,
sure
but I also.
Are. No, just kidding. Sorry.
Thank you, Michael. I also think the people living down the street from you or from Jennifer or Bruce or Michael or even myself ought to be here legally.
Right.
Yes.
And I don't think that that's asking too much, especially when I know I have the privilege of traveling around outside the United States. I see people who are dying to get here. They're standing in line, you know, in the UAE or in Qatar or wherever, and they're trying like crazy to get here. And they're all seeing America, which is supposed to be a bastion of the rule of law.
Fairness.
And the folks who are getting in front of them are folks who walked across the Rio Grande. And
because you don't want a wall.
Broke the law. They broke
and
the law.
And they broke the law. I don't think it's fair.
Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. I'm going to just take a personal note before we go back to discussion and offer condolences to the family of Mary Frances Fagan. Mary Frances Fagan was a longtime a reporter in the Chicago and Illinois area, longtime spokesman for American Airlines. She was one of the founding board members here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, responsible for many, many magical moments in the history of this museum. She died with a brain tumor. She died this morning in hospice at Rush Presbyterian Hospital. And again, to her and her family, we offer our condolences. And also, again, on a personal note, I visited Mary Frances earlier this week. And if you've never had someone that you cared about in hospice, you really should give some consideration to going and paying respects to them. Even though they may not understand every word you utter, the identity, the recognition with eye contact, and I think there was in our last conversation, I think there was some recognition. But I think it's important that wherever you are, sometimes you learn of someone. Most of the time, you learn of people that you know about and care about after they've gone. Every once in a while, in this particular case, you learn about someone literally in the last days of their lives. And if you ever are in that situation, to go and take a moment or take an afternoon or a morning and go over and pay tribute to them while they're alive, albeit in the closing days of their life in hospice. So our condolences to Mary Frances Fagan. Again, she will be greatly missed. Wow. And many of the great moments in the history of this museum, where we do this program from every night or every Sunday night, they go back to things that Mary Frances Fagan made happen when she was at American Airlines. Mm-hmm. So our condolences to her.
And may I add a comment to that?
Yes.
Today, February 4th, is actually National Cancer Awareness Day. Mm-hmm. And I say that as a person who has just completed a seven-month bout of a very rare form of stage 4 cancer. Mm-hmm. And I've been blessed with a lot of love and support. And I say this to anyone listening tonight. If you know someone who is dealing with cancer, reach out to them. Mm-hmm. Your prayers mean a lot. Your thoughts mean a lot. Your concern means a lot. Just to be calling, asking, how you doing? Mm-hmm. What can I do for you? Can I come over and just see you for a few minutes? Mm-hmm. It means a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Amen to both.
Yeah.
Amen to both.
Absolutely. I want to go back to an issue that goes back to the State of the Union. And that is the Democratic response.
Oh, yeah.
A young Kennedy from Massachusetts steps up, offers himself in front of an automobile shop.
Boy.
He got good reviews, as one would expect a Kennedy from Massachusetts to get good reviews. Did he do a good job, Chris? Can you look across the aisle and say he's okay?
Yeah, I think he was okay. He needs work. I think that it's a very tough assignment. And he did much better than other people who've had that assignment. I think that, frankly, I think that he represented, you know, the elitism and the sort of the bubble, and to have him in his constituency helped with that. But honestly, as a Republican, you know, you're looking at this guy with a broken down car behind him, and he's in Fall River, Massachusetts, right, you know, 20 miles from Chappaquiddick. And I just thought, folks weren't really putting all of this, all these images
together. That was a big meme that was going around. I think that he reminded me of someone who was giving a speech to be student body president. It really, the cadence, the delivery, the earnestness of it, which was appealing, I guess, in a way, but it was just very, he looks very young, and which I guess is an appeal in the Democrat Party because they need young blood. But yet it's the Kennedy family. So you're like, wow, and you're trying to get something new and fresh, but yet you're reaching back for the Kennedy family.
I thought it was fantastic. I could be speaking to, you know, this generation of Democrats that's excited to see, you know, younger people in the party and is excited at the face of the party. I thought it was amazing. I was empowered. I was excited. You know, I didn't notice the optics as much as the words he was saying that really resonated with me.
Michael Bauer.
I thought Joe Kennedy III gave a wonderful response to the State of the Union address. I thought he was very articulate. I thought he came across extremely well. However, I recognize there is a tremendous drop-off between viewership of the State of the Union address and the response to the State of the Union
right.
address.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tremendous drop-off. And what amazed me is that some people the next day were saying, oh, Joe Kennedy III for president in 2020. And I'm thinking, are we that bereft of possible candidates that someone gives one good speech?
Well, Oprah told you no, so you didn't get you lost Oprah.
Right.
I mean, I think the fact is that the party is bereft. And Joe Kennedy is probably many years from national. I thought that his cadence, honestly, sounded like a high school debater.
Yes.
He was overwhelmingly, to my eye, nervous and just barreling through this thing. And I thought that reduced its impact.
I want to go back and ask Alexander, because you mentioned that you're campaigning for a state representative in the North Shore of Chicagoland for those listening around the country. You said that when you knock on the doors, again, you're knocking on Democratic doors in an affluent area, and a lot of them are anti-Trump. What is your reaction, although the pundits quickly jumped on the president with the State of the Union in the wake of the State of the Union address the other day with some questionable analysis? The polls were very positive. The president zipped up to 49%. Are you surprised? Did all that theatrics of the State of the Union, does it disturb you that the president was able to make such a leap in one speech?
So I think he spoke better than he has ever, and I was happy to see that. I want a president who's a great leader, who makes me feel amazing to be American, and as someone who really wholeheartedly loves being American, I want our president to empower everyone. So I am happy that he spoke well, but I think that a lot of what he said was just not true. It didn't resonate with me. But I was really,
if he signed a Family Leave Act, would you be happy?
I'd be thrilled if we got family leave done. I think, Bruce, you know family leave is my big topic.
That's what I'm just saying.
I love it.
Some of the people in the resist movement, I mean, if Donald Trump comes back and says, okay, if you're an ex-offender, we're going to make it easier for you to get to a second chance. I mean, there's got to be all kinds of people on the Democratic side and Republican side that would say this is a great idea. But is there anybody else that's going to be honest like you did and just say, you know what, I could actually applaud and get excited if he did it? Because it's your pet issue.
It's totally
and
my
have
issue.
Your pet issue.
And if we can get family leave done, I'm going to be happy no matter what party's getting it done. What I find to be interesting, though, is I'm obviously running for state representative, and everyone at the doors is talking about federal politics. And I think it speaks to what's going on in our nation right now and that Trump is not regularly leading the way that we want him to. And so I think Republican or Democrat, I think that we're under a very different leadership than we're all used to.
We're out of time. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night.